Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. You probably have driven in a roundabout recently. A roundabout is a circular intersection where drivers travel counterclockwise around the center island. Roundabouts take the place of traditional intersections with stop signs or traffic lights, although there are roundabouts that utilize stop signs and lights. There are about 40 roundabouts on Pennsylvania roads today, and plans are in the works for about another 40 or so. The Pennsylvania Department of Transportation says roundabouts are safer because there are fewer crashes than in traditional intersections. But not all motorists understand driving through a roundabout. Some don't even like them. We're going to be talking about roundabouts today. Our guest is Jeff Bucher, Project Development Engineer and Roundabout Coordinator with the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, PennDOT. Mr. Bucher, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment about roundabouts, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Jeff Bucher, I have to say that this is a topic of our program that surprises me. Probably about, 7 or 8 years ago, we featured a conversation about roundabouts, and that was when they were first really introduced here in Pennsylvania. And the phones rang off the hook, and we got all kinds of emails. Already we've started with emails. Today, what's with roundabouts? Why do so many people have opinions about roundabouts?
Well, one of the big issues that confuses people is their comparison to the old New Jersey traffic circles. Actually, in Pennsylvania, we built our first modern roundabout in 2005. So any circular intersection in Pennsylvania older than 2005, we don't really consider a roundabout. There are more traffic circles. And other confusing points is the roundabouts are all yield controlled. We don't signalize them unless on some rare occasions we have to for pedestrians. And there's no stop control at them. So like the Gettysburg
Square
is actually a circle. It's not a roundabout because it has parking in the corners. It's very old. So modern roundabouts are fairly compact. Don't build them any larger than necessary.
So why are we building more in Pennsylvania? As I mentioned, 40 now. And as you mentioned, the modern roundabout has been since 2005 and probably another 40 in the works.
Yes. Actually, we're now up to about 48 roundabouts on our state routes and another 14 or so on our local network. Federal Highways has been pushing the implementation of roundabouts throughout the country since the mid-1990s, and the first modern roundabouts were essentially built around 1994, 1995. And the primary benefit is you're geometrically restricting the speed of the vehicles as they enter. And you're flaring them off at an angle with the yield. So any crashes you do have are sideswipe type crashes, resulting in much less severe injuries than the T-bone collisions that you have at traditional signalized intersections.
So what are some of the statistics, anecdotally, can you tell us? I mean, you just described it, but why, the roundabouts are safer than a traditional intersection?
Yes, that's generally true. We did a study for the past few years. Every year we do a study of roundabouts for the 3-year comparison of traffic crashes prior to implementation of the roundabout and then after implementation of the roundabout.
Same intersections.
Right, same intersection. Mm-hmm. And the one we just completed was for 19 intersections that were switched from stop control to roundabout intersections. And that's data going back to 2000. And that comparatively, our fatalities, there was one intersection that had two fatalities, but none of our and that was prior to it being a roundabout, obviously. But since the roundabouts have been implemented at all these locations, there haven't been any fatalities. We've only had one serious injury, which is a 90% reduction from beforehand. And even minor injuries were reduced by 79%, and crashes themselves were reduced by 34% from 138 down to 91. So, and another factor you have to consider here is through time, your traffic volumes increase and increase. So when we're comparing to 3 years, you know, from a decade ago to the current 3 years, the traffic volume through that intersection is likely much higher than it was. So there's, you know, more potential for conflict and so forth.
I'm going to jump around on you with some of these questions.
Sure.
But how is it decided where to put a roundabout? I have to admit, because, you know, I may refer to some specific places. Forge Road, Route 117 in Lebanon County, going into Palmyra, has a roundabout, which is out in the middle of farm fields. It just seems like an odd place for a roundabout.
That one, I don't know all the locations off the top of my head, but that one is right next to a small airport.
Yes.
And the roundabout was put in, and it only had, and they were adding a third leg to that intersection for a development. And the roundabout was put in so that they wouldn't have the higher mast arms and lighting poles and so forth that would interfere with the airport. And I believe that's one of the reasons that it was actually put there.
So there are more factors than just traffic volume, number of roads leading into it. But getting back to my original question, how is it decided where to put a roundabout?
Well, pretty much any major intersection improvement project where you'd have to widen for an additional left turn lane or right turn lane, we consider a roundabout option. And we also have a intersection control evaluation policy now that we start at the beginning of scoping for major intersection projects, which helps us decide what kind of intersection improvement would be best suited for that particular location.
What about cost? More or less than a traditional intersection?
Cost obviously comes up significantly commonly because the initial construction cost of roundabouts is typically more. But over the life, we usually use 20 years as a design life. Over the life of the project, the maintenance is significantly less. Plus, you have the indirect savings of the reduced delay, typically like 30% less delay for the vehicles traveling through it, and the significant injury reduction benefits. So over time, when you factor all that together, a lot of times it ends up being cheaper. And also, interchange locations, you're going to be seeing them more at interchanges. And one of the reasons for that is because what it goes by is wide node, narrow road, because the intersection itself has to be widened for the roundabout, but you don't need to widen the legs for the turn lanes. So many locations where you have an interchange, you don't necessarily have to remove the bridge. You can keep the existing bridge in there, which saves a lot of money because you can use a narrower road underneath it.
I want to go back to something you just said, and I want to make sure I'm clear on this. When you say delays, are you talking about for motorists that there's 30% less of a delay time than what would be there if there was a stop sign or a light?
Correct. Yeah, that's what the national studies have shown, and we did a study of a couple of our own locations. One roundabout built a few years ago at the Perry County and Cumberland County border there on 34 and Sunnyside Drive, and that had at least a 35% reduced peak PM delay. So commuters getting in and out of Harrisburg, it's been much more efficient for them. And another one out in Swarthmore, Delaware County, that was put in, that had a more than a 50% improvement on the delay in the morning and around 70% less delay in the PM peak hour.
Wow. Let me give the phone number again, because I see that we're getting a lot of emails and phone calls. 1-800-729-7532. We're talking about roundabouts during this portion of the program. I've already received a number of emails, so let me get into them. This is from, and if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Angelica. Starting about 15, 20 years ago, many intersections in Germany were converted to roundabouts for environmental and safety reasons. They are cheaper than traffic lights with respect to maintenance. In addition, there is no such thing as running through one or waiting for the light cycle when there are no other cars crossing. This saves gas, preventing unnecessary stops and starts. Roundabouts were already common in France and the UK, but German drivers initially balked, feeling insecure. By now, people are used to them, though, and appreciate the decreased wait times. What do you think about that?
I agree with that. Thanks for starting with a positive comment.
And yes. We have another one from Pam who says, just a quick comment and a request. The people who have problems with roundabouts are probably the same people who stop on acceleration ramps. They need to refresh their merge skills. Please, yes. Please encourage people to signal their exit in a roundabout. This helps people entering the circle and makes traffic move more smoothly.
Yes, some people don't really seem to understand what the word yield means, and they think that they're just going to go right in. But the intent is for the circulating traffic to continuously flow and the entry traffic to yield to the circulating traffic, which means slow down until there's a gap. And if there's not a gap, then you have to stop and wait until there is one. And then you can pull into the circle. That's the intent.
Kay from Hummelstown says, why would we consider building roundabouts only because of safety? They appear to take so much more land space, and we're already putting so much land under roads.
Well, like I mentioned earlier, the intersection itself can take more right-of-way, maybe 150 to 200-foot diameter, where a regular signalized intersection might be 100 feet diagonally or less. But like I said, the legs of the roundabout use less right away because you don't have to widen for your left turn lane and so forth. So there's a trade-off there. But yes, the safety benefits and operational benefits are quite significant. So that's one of the reasons where I'm and there's obviously locations where you can't put them if you're on the, you know, the side of a steep hill or something like that, or sensitive environmental resources or historic properties, stuff like that could cause an issue with where they're located, or if it's right near a railroad track, other issues like that. So
you basically need flat land to put a roundabout?
Not necessarily, but they've been built on grades. We're a little hesitant to do more than about a 4% grade for a roundabout.
I hope
at this
so. 4% is actually pretty significant,
but
isn't it?
In other parts of the country, they've been built on steeper grades than that. So, yes.
We have a lot of calls and emails coming in, and we'll get to them in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. On today's program, this segment of today's program, we're talking about roundabouts, something that are becoming more widespread on Pennsylvania roadways, and more are in the works. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Our guest today is Jeff Bucher, Project Development Engineer and Roundabout Coordinator with the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. Jeff, I have to ask, when you were named Roundabout Coordinator, did you ever think there would be such a title as Roundabout Coordinator?
Actually, I'm not the first one for the state.
Oh, you're not?
I started fall of 2010 as this position, but it started around 2006 or so, you know, about the time we got our first one built, they decided it would be a good idea to have a coordinator. Now it's kind of an additional job to my project development engineer
always
roles.
Always is.
So it's not like a full-time thing. It's So
you have to wear different hats. I have my roundabout coordinator hat on today.
Right. Yes,
okay.
That's true.
All right, let's take a call from Bill in Lancaster. Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Bill.
How are you?
Good. I'm doing well.
I have to say I agree 100% and particularly with what Angela said, because I've been in England and Europe quite a few times, and the roundabouts work. The one by the airport over here in Lancaster is very good, except that they've got to broaden a little bit the approaches because people are missing it and digging holes, and I'm afraid somebody's going to roll over. And what I observe is that people don't know how to use it and don't want to change. And it's the same mentality as we have with the zipper end of the two-way roads when they go in the one-way road at the construction. Even though PennDOT and the police, the state troopers, say, you're supposed to use the zipper, we still have knot-headed bozos and truck drivers that refuse to do it.
All right, Bill, thank you very much for your call. The zipper he's referring to, before we get to his comments on roundabouts, is when, as he described, two lanes going into one. Right. Everyone thinks that you should stay in the right lane, where the statistics show go in the left lane is really what makes more sense.
Correct. The traffic would flow through a lot better if people merged at the merge point and, you know, like a zipper together, but people get irritated at other people passing them and getting ahead of them, and so it doesn't always work that well.
Well, but getting back to Bill's original comment, though, about roundabouts, as he said that, you know, and maybe it is one of the reasons that there are some motorists out there that don't care for them, is because it is change, and it is something that is a little bit different here in the United States.
Correct. They're becoming quite a bit more prevalent now. There's over 5,000 across the country. Like I said, we're only about to hit 50 here on our state route system. But other states like Washington State, Wisconsin, Florida, North Carolina, they have around 400 or more on not necessarily on their state system, but on their within their state.
So. You know, I should take a step back. My very first question about what is a roundabout, and you mentioned circles, and a lot of people think of them as circles like they see in New Jersey. I have to tell you a quick story that when I was a young driver, there's a circle in Somers Point, New Jersey, leading to the bridge to Ocean City, New Jersey, that I drove around three times because I was in the inside lane and couldn't get out. So, it reminds people of the Chevy Chase movie, right. Vacation.
European Vacation.
Right,
yes.
Exactly. But so what is the difference between a circle and some places called rotaries and a roundabout?
Well, roundabouts are meant to be fairly compact, only as large as needed to accommodate the traffic volume and design vehicle. So you won't have any parking within the roundabout. You won't have access. You don't have access to the center island for anything. So there shouldn't be anything out there that would really attract pedestrians or anything. As for rotaries are typically very large. They've had them in Texas, maybe some in New Jersey, where you can enter in pretty high speed into the flow of the traffic and circle around and then exit. They're usually very large. And traffic circles themselves can vary greatly in size. A lot of times they require the circulating traffic to stop. They're like 90-degree angle entry on a lot of times. So there's a whole variety of what could be considered traffic circles. And roundabouts are a type of circular intersection, but we try not to refer to them as traffic circles.
Mm. Let's take another call. Speaking of pedestrians, Susanera has a question about pedestrians. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask, as a pedestrian, I find roundabouts horrible and try to avoid them as much as possible. In addition to adding distance to the walk, you also have the fact that cars aren't expecting to stop, particularly as they're exiting a roundabout, and it feels like crossing highway on an off-ramp. I feel like adding more and more roundabouts in our cities is just making them even less friendly for pedestrians and cyclists.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. I mean, I can picture what she's talking about, that that could be a problem.
Yeah, the crosswalks are typically 1 to 2 car lengths away from the circulating roadway to allow so that the vehicles are dealing with one conflict at a time. They arrive, they deal with the pedestrian crossing, then the circulating roadway, then as they exit, they have the pedestrian crossing again to deal with. Whereas at a signalized intersection, the pedestrian crossing is right at the signalized intersection and you have all those conflicts at the same point. In fact, for a vehicle, there are conflicts at a roundabout. There's only like 8 conflict points instead of the 32 that there are at a signalized intersection.
Right, what's a conflict point? You're talking engine. Your roundabout coordinator hat on
Where the vehicles have to enter interact with each other, where there's a potential for them to hit each other, including a pedestrian and so forth, that would be a conflict point. So that's much reduced with a roundabout. The pedestrians, the studies show that pedestrian safety between a roundabout and signalized intersections, there isn't a whole lot of data on it because there hasn't been many reports of pedestrian crashes that we could come across. But from what we have come across, they tend to be safer. But there's a lot, you know, there's a lot more signalized intersections and so forth than there are roundabouts. So, and bicycle. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Bicycles are considered vehicles. So with a roundabout, they're supposed to merge with the traffic and flow through using the lane. Or if there's a bike path beside it, they can exit, use the bike path, and get around as well.
But as a pedestrian, I can see what she was talking about, though, because you have those conflict points you talked about. People are not used to, even pedestrians are not used to seeing cars going around, and although I'm not talking about a circle, going in a circle counterclockwise, and it appears that there are more just by... the eye test appears to be more traffic moving toward you if you were crossing the street as a pedestrian.
Well, with a signalized intersection, you have issues with pedestrians with right turns on reds and so forth, where they're looking the opposite way as they're turning, and left turn movements and so forth conflict with pedestrian movements. Pedestrians and vehicles there seem to be overly reliant on the signals to tell them what to do, and they assume everybody's following what the signals are doing, but telling them to do. Where with a roundabout, you have to be, you know, self-alert, and the cars and everybody has to be paying attention. So you have to, you know, you can't be distracted or anything. You can't be texting while you're going through a roundabout.
All right, so now you brought up another point. I don't want to get off track, Jeff, but and you probably know the statistics, but it seems as though we're hearing a lot more reports of pedestrian vehicle crashes, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the country. Is that the case, and why?
Well, that's... getting a little off topic for me,
right,
but yes,
right,
there's
right,
a lot
right.
of distracted driving and distracted pedestrians. A lot of times pedestrians are staring at their phone while they're walking across in a crosswalk.
Not paying attention.
And they're not paying attention. Mm. And then, you know, the vehicle's trying to beat the red light and make it through the yellow or something. And yeah, so with a roundabout, you have to make sure you're alert and are aware of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a call from Jim in Enola. Jim, I hung up on you by mistake before, so welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Scott. I am a big fan of roundabouts. I remember a couple of decades ago traveling through New England and seeing a lot of roundabouts and thinking, boy, we ought to have these in Pennsylvania. And now, as your guest says, we are getting more and more of them. I think a particularly successful roundabout is one at Starrett's Gap on the Cumberland-Perry line at Route 34, because you got four roads coming together and you're coming over the crest of a hill. And that roundabout was put in, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, and I think it's extremely successful.
All right, Jim, thank you very much for your call. Is that the one you referred to earlier?
Yeah, that's one of the ones I mentioned earlier that had significantly reduced delay. And then I want to just point out that roundabouts are implemented for a variety of reasons. You know, there's obviously the reduction in injuries and so forth and delay, but they also are, you know, beautification aspects and gateways to communities and stuff like that. And in Pennsylvania, the signals are supposed to be maintained by the local municipalities. So with a roundabout, you don't have the signal maintenance and timing for the municipality to have to deal with. So that's a big cost savings and time savings to the municipality as well, because they don't deal with that.
You can't, in the island, you can't put something that impedes vision, can you?
You can. There's sight lines and intersection sight distance lines for the roundabout that go around certain edges, but you can have something in the center to a certain degree that can block straight through, because if you're approaching on a straight alignment, you want to make sure that people and vehicles are aware that there's a roundabout there and that it's not just a straight road continuing through. So it's good to have something in the center that blocks your vision a little bit, but not enough to block your sight triangles, as they call them.
All right, let's tell you a couple of emails here. Caller says, I have a lot of experience with roundabouts. I've lived in another place that had a lot of roundabouts, and I agree the incidence of major accidents is less, but I believe the incidence of minor fender benders are great. Understanding the rules is imperative.
Yes, understanding the rules is imperative. Yes, the minor fender benders are comparable and even, as I mentioned, are less from what we've studied for roundabouts compared to the intersections that were there before. But the general intent is, you know, reducing injuries, saving people's lives over avoiding fender benders and minor incidents.
We have another question that says, I actually got into an accident at the roundabout in Palmyra. I still believe people don't understand the rules of the roundabout. At what point will roundabouts be normal traffic occurrences in the state of Pennsylvania?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's depends on your perspective, I guess. They're scattered all across the state pretty much now. We got another 40 or so in design, which will probably be built, you know, within the next 4 or 5 years. So we're building maybe 10 or so a year. So you know, eventually it'll get to a point where people are so used to them. And general roundabout, it's in the driver's manual. We only have a couple that are multi-lane roundabouts or hybrid roundabouts that are, you know, four-way traffic in one direction and two in the other. Predominantly, pretty much all of them, except a couple, are just single lane roundabouts, which are fairly, I'd say, simple to deal with.
But it all depends on yielding at that point. And we have another email that says, please be clear that yield in a roundabout means yield once. Is that correct?
Yield in a roundabout is for the approaching traffic. As you come to your yield sign, you yield until there's a gap in traffic. And if you have to stop, you have to stop until there's a gap. You don't come up and stop and then just go, assuming that they're going to let you in. You're not you have to continually flow within the circulating roadway. You do not stop within the roadway to let people in. You have to keep going.
And that's even if you think you're being a polite driver at that point, right? That would disrupt the flow of traffic in the roundabout.
Correct, and that's a good way to have a little rear-end collision there in the roundabout if you stop to let somebody in and the person behind you runs into the back of you because you're not supposed to be stopping.
Another email. David says, the Highway 322 roundabouts at Milton Hershey School have raised high-raised planters and statues in the center that block the view of oncoming traffic. This relates to what you were talking about a few minutes ago. Are there any state guidelines for designs that require a clear sighting across the center of the roundabout?
There's criteria for the sight lines to be able to see the traffic coming around based on the speed that the traffic should be flowing within the roundabout, which is usually around 25 miles an hour. And like I said, you can have stuff in the middle. Now, those two in Hershey meet all the criteria and so forth, and they were privately funded by the Milton Hershey Foundation or whatever. So, and they just wanted those out there. They weren't really planned for PennDOT as an upgrade at the time to those intersections to be roundabouts, but Milton Hershey paid for them and so forth, and they functioned very well, and they're doing very well.
That brings up a point that a lot of people probably don't know. So the Milton Hershey School, the foundation, wanted those roundabouts there and agreed to fund them.
Right.
I mean, would there be an occasion where someone who wanted to do that and PennDOT said no?
That could happen because all the plans and traffic data and everything still has to be reviewed by PennDOT and make sure it's acceptable and meets all our criteria. Mm-hmm. And developers, as they come in and they have to do a highway occupancy permit to build. This is getting onto another issue, but the highway occupancy permit to access our roads. And then they have to study a roundabout option at the intersection where their driveway is tying into the state road as well for developers. And then the developer for whatever, Walmart or whoever's going in, would have to, would be funding that upgrade to put that roundabout in.
Let's take a phone call from Susan in Lancaster. Susan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I was so happy to hear about the difference between a circle and a roundabout, because I grew up in New Jersey. We retired here 2011, and up until 2011, they were on their way to getting rid of all the circles, the Bayway Circle, the Parkway Circle. In fact, one time when I was in college, I was coming off the Parkway at 136, and somebody was coming at me in the wrong direction on that circle. So I'm thinking to myself, well, why are they calling them roundabouts? Are they trying to be European? But it makes total sense now. The one on 222 going north is wonderful, up around Berks or Kutztown, that area, where it all got stopped up all the time. But I was just thrilled to hear that difference, and it makes sense, because the Bayway Circle now in New Jersey is a six-lane highway, as opposed to this nice little thing they're doing on Running Pump Road in East Hamfield, where I live. So thank you for the clarification, and it's very enlightening.
Thank you very much, Susan, for your call. I can hear a little New Jersey in Susan's yes. Speech. But,
yes.
You don't want to be going a car coming in the other direction. And that's not supposed to happen on a roundabout, a circle, or anything.
Yes. Somebody has all right turns.
Yeah, just keep making a right. It's like a NASCAR race.
They turn left.
Yeah, anyway. That's a left. But the same thing, yeah. Dave is in Lemoyne. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi. That was probably a visitor from the UK that got in the wrong lane there. But, I have a lot of experience with roundabouts because I live out of the country for a lot of the time. And there's a big difference between single-lane roundabouts and multi-lane roundabouts. And the protocol for people have to be aware of the protocol that you use your turn signal only when exiting the roundabout. People in this country don't particularly know that yet, and the people in Europe who have been using them for years, they know how to negotiate them, how to navigate them, so there's no problem. But I think as far as fender benders is concerned, I think it might even be more of a chance of having a fender bender, which I did in a roundabout, but it'll be a minor accident as opposed to being T-boned by somebody in an intersection. And they do save a lot of time, and the stopping, it's exasperating when you have to stop every block like you do around where I live, at a red light and wait for a long period of time. So that's all I wanted to say.
Dave, thank you very much for your call. He kind of covered a lot of area there, Jeff.
Yes, the one on 222, you have to remember we only have a couple multi-lane ones like that, and there's another one being put in up around Meadville in Mercer County. Anyhow, yes, when you're yielding to a multi-lane roundabout, you have to make sure you yield to both lanes of circulating traffic before you pull into the roundabout. And once you're in the roundabout, if you're in the inner lane, you stay in the inner lane until you get to your exit, and then you exit. You shouldn't be weaving within the roundabout.
This is a question a few people have had, and not exactly this specific, but generality. Rich asked, why can't PennDOT start doing public service announcements about roundabouts, maybe a multimedia campaign?
That would be a good idea, but that's our press office, not me. So
the press office has to get out
getting the word out. We got more out on social media now, Facebook and so forth. We have our website with links to that. There's a couple videos on our website that's useful. Federal Highways has a very good safety website with a lot of information. And there's lots of YouTube videos out there about roundabouts, even for bicyclists going through roundabouts and so forth, which are very informative. So there's lots of information out there on them.
Another caller said, it seems that roundabouts are more difficult to maintain when there is snow. Is that true?
Not necessarily. I mean, a plow has to circle around it. And once they exit the roundabout, sometimes it's difficult for them to find a location to turn around to come back and plow back through it. But there's, like, Wisconsin and Colorado, there's lots of snow states. New York State has a lot of roundabouts. And they manage it just fine.
Pennsylvania.
And so do we.
Okay. I was going to say, you better plug in for Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Jeff Bucher is a project development engineer, roundabout coordinator with the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. Jeff, lots of questions here today. Thank you very much for answering those questions.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. In today's 24-hour news cycle, with breaking headlines, all news networks and online outlets, they're all competing for viewers' attention. A new program on PBS and WITF aims to widen the discussion, revealing the story behind the story, and providing new insights into how today's events have been shaped by the past. Retro Report on PBS is a one-hour magazine format series that premieres tonight and Tuesday on PBS and WITF TV. We're joined now by the executive producer of Retro Report, Kira Darnton. Ms. Darnton, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Ms. Darnton, tell us about Retro Report. What can viewers expect?
Well, Retro Report is a show that is trying to bring context to today's headlines. So, in fact, I've been sitting here thinking about what is the Retro Report on Roundabout, for example. Taking something that's happening today and trying to give some historical context to help you understand it better. So one example I really love to use, because we think of it as such a modern phenomenon, is our addiction to social media. How many people are refreshing their Facebook and Twitter and Instagram all the time, feeling they need to be connected. Well, it turns out you can really understand that better by looking back at research that was done in the 1950s with a psychologist called B.F. Skinner, who talked about something called the variable reward, which was the most addicting principle, which is this idea basically that you know something's coming, but you don't know quite how good it's going to be. So it just keeps you hooked and keeps you in the corner kind of refreshing at all times. So I think it's that kind of context. It just helps you understand things that we take for granted today.
Well, and that's just it. I have to say, and this is just a personal experience, before I produced my first radio or TV program, I was told by our CEO and president at the time, who had a journalism background, that to make sure that historic perspective was a part of anything that we produced, because the issues that we're dealing with today are not unique for the most part. There's almost always some precedence or path leading to today's issues. And that sounds exactly what Retro Report is doing, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think in this day and age where we're just kind of, you know, inundated with tweets and headlines and you don't quite know what to think, we've really lost sight. And there can be, you know, kind of great comfort, I think, found in the fact that a lot of these issues we dealt with before, you know, sometimes it can be a little depressing. We haven't learned the lessons of history, but in other cases we have. And so I think it just, you know, while some things are unprecedented about today, other things I really think you can find comfort in looking to the past.
Yeah, obviously a lot of things have changed. I mean, technology and how things are done. We have things, tools available to us today that we didn't, but the principles of them are still the same. Why don't we as a society, or even those in positions to make change, look to the past to have a better understanding?
That's a good question.
I know. I mean, it would seem to make sense. You would have a better understanding of an issue and maybe even help to find a solution.
I mean, completely. Obviously, I agree with you. But what's been interesting to me is, you know, so Retro Report itself is a nonprofit news organization. So we've been doing short videos on the internet for about 6 years. And what we do is we go back and we try to find the original participants who were involved in an old story or a kind of moment. It's really more modern history. And we say to them, what do you wish you knew then that you know now? How has your perspective evolved? And I think that's really one of the most valuable things we can do. It's re-reporting these events and helping us understand. You know, often there was an immediate reporting that was misperceived by the public. You know, things kind of, there's like an excitement around an initial story, and that turns out not to be true. It's certainly true with science stories. So I think taking that time and doing that reporting to find people and let them be able to tell you, you know, I wish I'd known that this is how things would go, can be really helpful when looking to the future.
Well, we have an example, and this is actually one of the stories that you can see on Retro Report. What happened when people witnessed a crime decades ago? Now, this is a reference to the case we're talking about is the Kitty Genovese case, where in New York City, where a crime was committed, and a lot of people, in fact, it was thought at the time that no one reported it, and how their reactions predicted the way we react to online violence today. What about that?
That's such a great example because it taps into just what we're talking about. So even just, I think it was 2 weeks ago, there was a horrible story in Long Island about a boy who was stabbed, a teenager who was stabbed, and the kids around him all filmed it to put it on Snapchat. And it was a horrible event, and everybody said, what's wrong with this digital generation? What is it about technology that's causing them to do this? But it actually is really helpful to understand that there is something called the bystander effect, which means the more people witness a crime or someone in trouble, the less likely they are to intervene. And that came about after a murder in the 1950s called the Kitty Genovese murder, when a woman was murdered and so many people didn't respond in that moment. And so psychologists figured this thing out. So it is something in human nature. And while, again, the technology does change things, I think it is comforting to know that you know, human nature as a whole is not being completely transformed.
When you say so many people didn't report the Genovese murder, I mean, at the time, that was one of the big questions, is why would so many people stand there and not report it. You actually, for the story on Retro Report, talked about some people who actually did report it, correct?
Yes. So that's also been oversimplified. It's just a great example of what we're talking about, right? I think the New York Times ran an initial story that said 38 people heard this and witnessed it and didn't do anything. And that turned out now, with the passage of time, not to be entirely true. There were a few people who did, you know, call 911. Well, there wasn't actually 911 at that time, but who called police. There were people who, you know, they didn't all witness it in the way it was reported. But that said, that news story got so much attention that it caused psychologists to actually set up studies. And you can see these kind of amazing recreations of these studies in the film, but where they tested the theory. And the bystander theory has really held up over the years. So even though the details of that original story weren't entirely reported accurately, this idea that, you know, the more people who witness something, the less likely any one of them is to intervene has held up.
You know, there may be some people, though, who will see some of the stories that you're producing in Retro Report, and a lot of it will have to do with the initial media reports that you just mentioned, the New York Times with the Genovese crime that was committed. I mean, at a time today when there are, you know, unfortunately, a large segment of the population that doesn't believe that the journalists are telling the full story or, in fact, even telling lies. I mean, I hesitate to use the term fake news, but are there some stories that will make the media look bad? Or, I mean, with these initial reports, they weren't done out of bias or weren't done because of bad journalism. It was just what they knew at the time, correct?
Well, that's the most important thing. You've just hit on it. You really nailed it, which is we're not looking back and saying, oh, look, the media got it wrong. We're actually trying to help you understand why and how these things happen and give you that perspective. So one of my favorite areas of interest for us is science, early science reporting. And that's because it's often misinterpreted by people who don't fully understand the scientific process, right? So in science, you have an early finding and it looks to be very extreme. And then the rest of the science community actually does more research and follow-up studies. And over time, it whittles down that extreme early finding. And you really can see the nut or the truth to something. And that is actually how the scientific process works. But, you know, all too often, journalists who maybe don't have that kind of background in science are jumping on the first story and saying, oh my God, I mean, that just happened last week with the diets. Did you see that? You know,
about the red meat?
Meat's fine now, right? Yeah. And that's actually the process in some ways, right? It's actually more complicated and it's not easily translated into headlines and tweets and kind of the way things are today. So for me, it actually causes me great comfort to know when I'm reading a story about early science to ask those questions and say, how many people were in that study? How, you know, what perspective should I bring to this? So I don't think we're turning back and kind of calling people fake news as much as we're actually just trying to understand and give you context to make you a smarter viewer and to help you know what to think about the world we're living in today.
You know,
at least I hope. That's our goal. You'll have to tell me after you watched it.
Well, I'm really looking forward to watching it tonight and tomorrow night for the series premiere. But I have to tell you that when you were describing science, especially, the first thought that came to mind was that study last week that came out about red meat not being as bad for you as what we've heard. So that must have really struck a chord with a lot of people. The show is hosted by Celeste Headlee and Masoud Alafani. Annie Borowitz offers what is described as a lighter touch near the end of each program. What is that lighter touch?
So he basically is creating these mini documentaries in the same premise of the project, right, which is using history to understand today. But he does it in a humorous way. So, for example, he looks at political apologies, kind of public apologies by politicians over the years. And he has this amazing team of researchers, and they pull this, you know, you could just almost run them by themselves, politicians apologizing without really apologizing. But then he puts his own take on it and ties it back to history and looks back at the famous Nixon Checker speech, which, you know, if you remember, was when Nixon was accused of kind of early political misconduct. He turned it into something talking about his puppy, his kid's dog, the Checker speech, and changed the conversation. And so he just uses that and kind of says in a funny way, maybe politicians today should be using pets. You know, not enough of them are using that.
Well, you know, one of the things that I as a viewer particularly like from the previews that I've seen is that you have a lot of the original footage, a lot of the original video when you're telling these stories. So there is, you see a lot of history along with just talking about it.
Yes. I do think that's one of the real values, right, is actually remembering. And a lot of people remember how stories were covered. And I should just mention, you know, how much we've worked with WITF a little bit. They've really just done these kind of two amazing stories looking at both at Three Mile Island and the intellectual disability rights movement. And that's just been such a great opportunity to see what other people can do when they're tying their own community's history, you know, to today.
Yeah, I should mention that, and I'll ask you about it, and we only have about 90 seconds left, but that there is a local component to this, correct?
That's the most exciting thing, honestly, because, you know, for us, we're a nonprofit. We really just want people to think critically about the world and think about history and tie it to today and to see the amazing stories that you know, different producers from different stations have done has just been the most validating, and I hope it's just the beginning.
And I should mention this, that WITF in partnership with State Impact Pennsylvania will host a local retro report discussion from invasive species to the TMI shutdown. Some of Pennsylvania's top environmental headlines have roots in historic events. Join me Wednesday, October 23rd from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the WITF Public Media Center as I host a retro report screening and panel discussion. We'll talk talk about climate change, invasive species, water quality, and more. Register to attend at WITF.org/events. And don't miss Retro Report premiering tonight at 9 p.m. on WITF-TV. New episodes air Mondays and Tuesdays through October 29th. Kira Darnton, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the first episode tonight. And we're happy to be working with you as well.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Kira, thank you very much. That is today's Smart Talk. We will talk to you tomorrow morning, so have a good day.